The United Nations General Assembly begins next week in New York. This year, some key players are staying home.
Both the Russians and the Chinese see the General Assembly as being a game that the U.S. is playing on its home turf.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, a year ago, a young Iranian woman died in police custody. It sparked a movement among Iranian women. The protests have diminished, but not the mood.
A new solidarity has emerged in Iran.
And the Royal Ballet School is the top program in Britain. Former students now claim the school has a toxic culture of body shaming and unrealistic demands to be thin.
You cannot be expected to perform to the highest standards, the highest jumps, the fastest spins, if you're operating on a couple of hundreds calorie per day.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. The Dominican Republic and Haiti have a history of tense relations. This morning, things got even worse. Authorities in the Dominican Republic closed the border with Haiti and stopped issuing visas to Haitian citizens. As The World's Tibi Saizea reports, this latest dispute is about water.
The Dominican Republic and Haiti shared the same Caribbean island called La Española. The border between the two countries runs along the Massacre River, named after a bloody battle in the 18th century. The two countries agreed decades ago to share water rights from the river and not to change its natural course. But in recent years, a group of Haitian farmers started building a canal on their side of the border. It wasn't clear who, if anyone, authorized this project. It was halted for a year or so, but 2 weeks ago, it resumed. And that sparked anger from Dominican officials.
Según el tratado, es ilegal también, porque todas lo que son las aguas fronterizas deben de coordinarse.
President Luis Abinader told reporters that the canal is, quote, a provocation that his government is not going to accept. He said by diverting the river, Haiti will break their long-standing agreement and hurt Dominican farmers. This morning, Abinader deployed the military to enforce the closure of the border. Now, why are Haitian farmers building this canal? I put that question to Diego Darin, a researcher in Haiti for the International Crisis Group.
The initiative is being spearheaded by various local peasant groups who feel neglected by the government in the agricultural area of the Marie-Barou Plain.
The region has been dealing with a severe drought for years. Diego Darin says residents are tired of being ignored by local officials, so they came up with their own plan.
It's citizens organized in Combit who decided to resume the project. The Combit is a form of collaborative work in Haiti in which members of a community come together to undertake collective work for which they are not paid.
The canal would irrigate thousands of acres of land. The Haitian government said it didn't authorize the project. But some officials argue that the canal does not violate the treaty, and critics of the closure say nationalist politicians in the Dominican Republic want to capitalize on anti-Haitian sentiment ahead of next year's elections. But what's clear is that the decision to close Haiti's only land border will have an impact. Yves Marie Chanel is a Haitian businessman who lives close to the area where the canal is being constructed.
Las medidas tomadas por el gobierno dominicano eran exageradas. La decisión de
he says the Dominican response is exaggerated and will hurt the economy of both countries. Trade between the two nations is worth nearly $1 billion a year. But Haiti is really struggling now. Many people there can't find basic food items in their own country, so they cross the border into the Dominican Republic to get them. The decision to cancel visas for Haitians is also problematic, according to Josue Gastelbondo. He heads the mission of the International Organization for Migration in the Dominican Republic.
República Dominicana es el paso de Haití para pasar por aeropuertos y viajar.
He says Haitians depend on Dominican airports for international travel, and that the border closure is essentially locking Haitians within their own country at a time when violent crime is out of control. So far, Haitian farmers working on the canal show no signs of stopping. In fact, It's quite the opposite. In the past few days, they have speeded up construction. On Wednesday, a delegation from Haiti traveled to Santo Domingo, the Dominican capital. But after 11 hours of negotiations, there was no apparent solution. For the World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
A 52-year-old man was killed by two dogs in the United Kingdom yesterday. Today, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said his government would seek to ban the breed, the American XL Bully.
These dogs are dangerous. I want to reassure the public that we will take all necessary steps to keep people safe.
So just how dangerous is this breed? To explore that, we reached out to Jane Williams, a clinical animal behaviorist in the UK. Jane, what is the American XL Bully? Describe the breed.
Obviously, as the name suggests, the breed was created in the States. In terms of the type of dog that we see that people describe as an XL Bully, it is a large bull breed, similar in some regards to the American Bulldog. But also we have a British bulldog as well. And those bull breeds are very strong and they have powerful heads and jaws. So they are a particular type, but they're not really easily defined here. So it covers a whole range of variations, really.
Now, as you explained, they're American. It's the American XL Bully. Mm. Are the dogs that are in the UK of this breed, are they imported from the US or are they being bred now in the UK?
They are being bred in the UK, and unfortunately, bulldogs generally have quite a lot of health problems due to the way that they're bred. And we've unfortunately got a group of people in the UK who are breeding extreme forms of these dogs as well, so they're creating even more health issues.
So what has led Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to ban this breed?
So we've had a number of tragic incidents in the UK involving bites and fatalities. Until recent years, the number of fatalities caused by dogs in the UK was 3 per year. But in the last few years, that has increased in percentage terms significantly to round about 12. So this is obviously still an incredibly rare event in the UK. But that's not to diminish anyone. Obviously, every single case is a tragedy and one that we would try hard to avoid. But we've already had breed-specific legislation in the UK since 1991. And clearly, it hasn't worked. Otherwise, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, he's calling the American XL Bully dangerous. Is that fair? I mean, are they bred to be dangerous?
There is no evidence that XL bullies are any more aggressive or likely to be aroused to aggression than other breeds. But we certainly do see incidents where the humans responsible for the dogs were not behaving in a sensible way.
In what way?
Obviously, there are some very responsible XL bully owners who do care for their dogs. But we also have a group of people in the UK who are associated with criminality, who use dogs like this for the purposes of protection, self-protection, protection of money, protection of drugs.
So you say that it's about educating dog owners and that that's where the change has to be. But how do you do that practically? It's like a public health campaign. It takes time. How would that actually work?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why the politicians go for something quicker, isn't it? Because they can be seen to be doing something. It's a very complex problem. And one of the main things that we need to do is look at the responsible sourcing of dogs, and not just of these breeds, but we still have puppy farms in the UK. In the States, I think you call them puppy mills. Dogs that come from these sources have already potentially been damaged and have not got a good start in life. So we need to look at that. And we do have legislation in place in the UK where we could control that. But unfortunately, there aren't enough resources put into enforcement of that. Without enforcement and without proper resources to still ensure animal welfare in terms of this, we're not going to move the situation forward.
We've been speaking to Jane Williams. She's a clinical animal behaviorist in the UK. Jane, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
The Sahel region in West Africa has seen a series of military coups in recent years. There was Mali in 2021, Burkina Faso the year after, and just a few months ago, Niger. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, reports on how things have changed or not changed since the coups.
News of these coups in West Africa all played out in similar ways. Patriotic music started playing on national television, and then generals appeared wearing military fatigues to announce that they were taking over and promising to fix the security situation in their countries once and for all. The Sahel region has been dealing with widespread violence from terrorist groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda for years. Reda Liamori is with the Policy Center for the New South think tank. He tells me domestic conflicts in these countries have fueled the rise of terrorism.
There were already some vulnerability drivers that contributed that were exploited by jihadist groups. That's what led eventually to the explosion of the conflict.
International assistance has come in various forms over the years, including a United Nations peacekeeping mission in Mali, a U.S. military base in Niger, and thousands of French troops across the region.
The French, in addition to the U.S. and other partners, in addition to providing support to national armies operations, they were also providing different supports, either in terms of equipment, intelligence. Also, in many cases, national armies will request airstrikes.
But local leaders in the Sahel have criticized their international partners for failing to solve the terrorism crisis. After the coups, military leaders ordered French troops to leave Mali and Burkina Faso. A few months ago, Mali's foreign minister, Abdoulaye Diop, requested that the United Nations end its 10-year-old peacekeeping mission there.
La MINUSMA n'a pas atteint son objectif fondamental. Aujourd'hui, les Maliens sont
Diop said that the UN mission hadn't been effective in bringing security to Mali and may have even made the problem worse. He said that the Malian people are happy to have their own armed forces defend the country. He asked Reda Liamori, the expert, whether military coup leaders have succeeded in turning the tide against terrorist groups.
They have not lived up to what they have promised and what they have used as an excuse to justify the coups.
In fact, the security situation continues to get worse, he tells me. There have been a wave of attacks against civilian and military targets.
The jihadist groups continue to expand. In addition to conducting violence, jihadist groups control areas in Mali and Burkina Faso.
According to a UN report, the Islamic State has nearly doubled the size of its area of control in the past year. El-Ghassim Wan is the top UN representative for Mali. Here he is addressing the UN Security Council in June.
Celle-ci reste marquée par la pression continue que continue d'exercer l'État islamique dans le nord-est du Mali.
He said continued pressure by the Islamic State in Mali is leading to endless violence against civilians. But now the UN mission is racing to withdraw some 13,000 peacekeepers by December at the behest of military leaders. There are concerns about what the absence of that peacekeeping mission and the pullout of French troops will have on security. Analyst Reda Liamori says in a worst-case scenario,
that will create an environment for the jihadist groups again to reestablish its force, its presence, and continue to expand because national forces do not have the capabilities to face these groups.
It might be too early to say what the latest coup in Niger will mean for security in the region. About 1,000 U.S. troops are still stationed in that country. For now, the Pentagon says those forces will stay to help with the fight against terrorist groups. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It happens every September in New York City. World leaders gather for the United Nations General Assembly. But this year, not everyone RSVP'd yes. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was a highlight of last year's General Assembly when he appeared in a pre-taped video message.
Greetings to all people of the world who value peace and unity between different and equal nations. I wish you all peace.
But this year, Zelensky will address the crowd in person for the first time since Russia's full-scale invasion. Richard Gowen, the UN Director for the International Crisis Group, expects him to be the star of the show again.
A lot of leaders will just want some FaceTime with him and a photo opportunity with him.
But Gowen says the meetings offer a much bigger moment for Zelensky himself to connect with leaders from non-Western countries.
Many of whom have wanted to stay neutral in the war, or at least avoid offending Russia by criticizing it too much. And Vladimir Putin is not going to be in New York, so Zelensky has a pretty clear run to go to some of those leaders and make the case that they should be back in Kiev more strongly.
Gowen points out that Putin has skipped the General Assembly many times before. So has China's Xi Jinping. One reason for this:
both the Russians and the Chinese see the General Assembly as being a game that the US is playing on its home turf. It's an event where the US president is always one of the first speakers,
which gives the US the power to shape a lot of the agenda, he says. But the meetings are only held in New York because the UN headquarters are there. Gowen adds Putin in particular would also face a barrage of criticism from US and European leaders if he showed up.
I sincerely doubt that, given the state of geopolitics, we'll ever see Putin come back to the General Assembly for as long as he remains president.
What is surprising, though, is that French President Emmanuel Macron and UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak are also staying home.
It's been a while since this has happened.
Gideon Rabinowitz is the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Bond, a network for UK international charities. He points out that it's been a decade since a British Prime Minister decided to not attend the General Assembly. That was David Cameron back in 2013. Sunak and Macron are reportedly staying put because Prince Charles is visiting Paris next week. But Gowen points to the fact that both leaders just returned from the G20 in India.
At a certain point, they have to stop going from summit to summit. They have to be seen to be back at home, rolling up their sleeves, dealing with domestic problems. And so they prioritize the G20 over the UN.
Rabinowitz makes the same observation, and it concerns him.
The UN is, by definition, the place where everybody has a say, and the G20 is not fully representative of the international community. And so it is worrying that people are moving away from spaces which are fully representative.
For the countries that are not invited to the G20, though, the UN General Assembly can be an important stage. Mwita Chacha is an associate professor of international relations at the University of Birmingham. He expects Niger to use the forum to legitimize the recently appointed prime minister after President Mohamed Bazoum was overthrown by a military coup in late July.
Now the world will know that those in charge of Niger are the junta, and this prime minister, this interim prime minister, is their representative.
Whether the global community accepts that, Chacha says, is another question. He'll be watching how other world leaders respond and what they have to say about the increasing number of coups across Africa.
If we are to place into the broader context that what's happening with these coups is a backsliding of democracy and democratic governance is embedded in the Sustainable Development Goals, then it will be interesting to hear what the world has to say about what's happening in Africa at this moment.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres set his expectations in a press conference this week.
My appeal to world leaders will be clear. This is not a time for indifference or indecision. This is a time to come together for real practical solutions. It's time for compromise for a better tomorrow. Next week, here in New York, is the place to start.
The UN General Assembly kicks off on Tuesday, when both Zelensky and U.S. President Joe Biden are expected to take the stage. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Youth activists and many of their parents are gearing up for a weekend of climate marches across the globe. The global climate strike is calling for the end to the use of fossil fuels. Bhavreen Kandari is one of those parents heading out to protest this weekend. She co-founded Warrior Moms in India, and she joins us from London. Bhavreen, it's interesting, these marches and these actions around climate change, they're global and they're youth-led, but it's September, so it's also back to school season. How does that affect the coordination of these marches?
Yes, of course. I mean, if you remember, the global strike for future was anyway something that you missed the school. So I'm sure the kids don't mind doing that because it is something so much more important. And I hear the kids say that, many children say that. You know, when you, in fact, they're taking a little bit advantage of that too, that, you know, this is extremely important and critical. And, you know, and what's the point of going to school if you don't have a future?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it was young people, people like Greta Thunberg, who really started these kinds of marches and these kinds of really direct actions. And now parents are getting involved too. What inspired you to get involved?
Carol, I think it's desperation for most parents. Because when we see that there's not much scope, or we are seeing that, you know, we're talking about the 1.5 degree, and we have already, you saw what happened in the last 2 months and the crazy situations. You know, someone like me who's from Delhi, and we had a study in 2019 where it said that every third child in Delhi has damaged lungs. You know, we're talking of air pollution. We've been saying that for years, but the damage has been done. Now, for example, my twin girls who are born there and brought up there, there is no escape for them. So what does that mean? I mean, as a parent, we want to do the best for our child. We want to give them the best education. We want to give them the best of everything, you know, clean homes and lovely food and everything. We want to do the best for them. I'm talking even, forget, this is an equity issue. I'm not even getting into that. I'm even saying for the elite. But then what are we giving? We're giving them poison in every breath that they take.
What would you say has been the impact of these ongoing climate strikes? I mean, do you feel like they're having an impact, or are you frustrated?
No, yes, big time. I mean, impact, yes. It's bringing in people. It's bringing in numbers. It's bringing in, there's an awareness that's come. But yes, if you ask me that there have been some drastic changes that that the world has done, no. I mean, yes, there is more number of times everybody talks of climate change. Everybody, you know, these have become every politician's speeches, every leader's favorite terms. But it's a long way to go. There's a long way to go. And it has to be now.
I've been speaking with Bhavreen Kandari. She's the co-founder of Warrior Moms in India. We've been discussing the annual summit, the Global Climate Strike, which is calling for an end to fossil fuel use. Thank you so much, Bhavreen.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much for having us.
Ever feel like a man just isn't paying attention to you? It's possible their thoughts are caught up in ancient Rome. Yep, it's a trend.
Not just men thinking about the Roman Empire, but also, I suppose, the incredulity of their female friends, spouses and partners that, why would you think about the Roman Empire at all?
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tomorrow will be 1 year since the death of Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old woman who died in police custody in Iran. Amini had been accused of not wearing a headscarf properly. Her death sparked one of the largest women-led uprisings in Iran since the Islamic Revolution. In recent months, the streets of Iran have been quiet. Still, many Iranian women say they're going through their own internal revolution. Reporter Fariba Nawa has our story. And a note, the women Fariba spoke with asked her not to use their full names for fear of reprisal.
This summer, a friend sent me this video from a restaurant in northern Tehran. Women and men mingle in an outdoor garden decorated with lights. A live band plays as one woman holds her headscarf in her hand, waving it as she dances. Other women have no headscarves. Much of this is illegal in Iran, but many women say they'll continue to bare their heads regardless of the consequences.
"28-year-old
Ardi says what's changed for her is that she's been injected with courage. She's a university student from Isfahan doing her graduate work in biotechnology. Ardi no longer wears the headscarf. "I used to be very afraid of the morality police," Ardi says. "I would shiver and change my path when I saw them approaching. But now I just walk past them. And if they mention something about my clothes, I even curse at them. The police have become even more aggressive. But when I think of the youth who died for us, for this cause, it gives me this courage to stand up to them." After Mahsa Amini's death in detention in September, Iranians demonstrated throughout the country, demanding individual rights, regime change, and an end to human rights abuses against women and minorities. They chanted, "Women, life, freedom," across Iran and in the diaspora, a slogan that began among Kurds and now echoes in pop music videos in different languages. The government responded with brutal force, maiming and killing hundreds of protesters and arresting tens of thousands of people. Pooran Nazimi, a renowned women's rights activist, has been in and out of the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. Her sister, Mahshid Nazimi, has been speaking on Pooran's behalf from Turkey. Our demands are not just about the headscarf, Mahshid Nazimi says, but we want a democratic government, and we're against a religious government. She says religion can no longer be used as a weapon to oppress women. In December, the government began executing protesters, and the movement became quieter. Meanwhile, the morality police, who have been a mainstay of the Islamic Revolution, disappeared, giving women the space to dress more freely, only to show up again this summer as the anniversary of the uprising neared. Gulriz Shen is an Iran expert at Tobe University of Economics and Technology in Ankara.
It's mainly about killing the momentum of the protests and erecting new walls of fears.
Iranians told me in the last few weeks that internet access has been interrupted, surprise checkpoints set up, and academics fired for supporting the uprising. A new law to give harsher punishments to women not covering their hair is being implemented. Tomorrow, Mahsa Amini's family plans a public commemoration, and protests are expected across the world this weekend. Shan says in Iran, the protests dissipated, but the revolutionary mood is looking for new sparks.
A new solidarity has emerged in Iran since the start of the protests. And Iran's generations that would not give up looking for greater liberties. As to women, they continue to their daily resistance. They continue to defy the norms imposed upon them. Their demands are no longer lost within the broader demands of the societies.
Women in Iran say another big shift in the past year has happened with the men in their lives. MB is an artist who travels to several provinces of Iran and took part in the protests.
In باور به حجاب
She says this belief in hijab, that something should be on my head or my coat should be short or long, this belief has been disappearing in the minds of our men. The men who were against us in the revolution of Mahsa are now with us. MB says before the protests, the men in her family would remind her if her headscarf slipped off in public.
اما اتفاقی که توی یک سال افتاد اتفاق درونیه اینجوریه که اگر که من مثلا
MB says another change she's noticed is that Iranians have stopped adhering to laws that discriminate against equality. The law is no longer sacred. MB says more and more religious Iranians say they want Islam to be a private matter rather than state imposed. Still, a large portion of the population considered qishr khakestari, or the gray sector, will remain silent, and many also support the government. MB talked to me from Zahedan, where the ethnic Baloch live. She says even though minority Kurds and Baloch stood up to the government, conservative viewpoints about women remain in these communities. MB says, I'm staying with a Baloch friend right now, and we were going to get sunglasses. And the girl with me said, I can't. My brother has broken my glasses several times because it's taboo for girls to wear them. But MB is still hopeful that the women's resistance happening in the capital, Tehran, will trickle to the villages and beyond. For the world, I'm Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
Spend enough time online and you probably get hit by an advertisement that is so well targeted, it's creepy. How does the internet even know that I was daydreaming about getting a Vespa? It's a thing some tech experts call surveillance capitalism. Convenient, annoying, a bit weird. And now, a threat. Israeli cyber firms are building spyware that can infiltrate your computer and learn everything about you from those ads. Omer Ben-Jacob is a reporter with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He got the scoop. He joins us from Tel Aviv. Omer, break down how this targeted ad system works and how the spyware fits into it.
I think we've kind of known for the past few years that there's these kind of military-grade spywares, what I would call digital arms. And these are kind of programs that allow governments to hack into devices that the producer of these devices don't want you to hack into. So it de facto allows you to break into iPhone, Android, or PC systems. Microsoft and Apple and Google don't want governments to be able to do this, and they don't want this kind of what we call hacking abilities to be sold around. That's one side of the story. So we've known that's always existed. As Apple and all these kind of big tech firms closed different exploits and kind of cramped down the style of these different digital arm sales firms, the firms behind them have discovered that there's this amazing endless world of advertising for a technology that can be used for actually hacking. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing the use of commercial advertising data to actually track people, but also in rare cases to actually hack into their devices, actually put a spyware in the ad so you will be infected even if your iPhone is up to date and even if you've kind of made sure not to click on any malicious links and you're very responsible.
So making this kind of spyware is totally legal and can be sold on the up and up?
So it's considered a military technology. So spywares are, or high-end spywares that can hack an iPhone with what we call zero clicks, are at least within Israel or within the Israeli defense establishment considered a military export. It's the same way you can, you know, legally create a gun and legally create a rifle and legally create a missile, and you can legally sell them within the legal international arms market. In a sense, there's now intelligence agencies and intelligence bodies that utilize this data. So you would see the ad for Vespa, though you had never articulated wanting a Vespa. That can now also be used to actually track you and to actually penetrate and infiltrate your device, which is something that is just supposed to be completely impossible. And the reason it's possible is because in our day and age, the name of the game in advertising is collecting data. So everything from your location to your search histories is stored, and there is actually tons of use for that data, even if you're not an advertiser.
But of course, it isn't being used for just military ends. That's what's so weird about it.
You're right. It's not just being used for military, because I think what we're always seeing is that there's this process of kind of leakage or spillover from the world of defense to the private defense contractors and then to the civilian market. So the same way guns used to be, or rifles used to be, something that you could only within that kind of military world have access. And over time, we've seen them leaking out. Digital arms are the same.
Can the companies who are putting up these ads, presumably Google, Apple, a few others, do they have any ability to defend themselves against this spyware?
That's a great question, but I think there's kind of, you asked the question in the wrong way. Google and Apple don't put the ads there. That's the point. Google and Apple only open a window on our mobile devices and on our phones in which advertisers can put ads. What Google and Apple actually do is maintain these really large automatic exchanges in which advertisers actually compete to put an ad into our phone. And what Google and Apple do is just kind of put together this bidding process and allow them to put the ad on our phone, but they don't take responsibility for the ad itself. They're not actually the one putting the ad there. You know, they'll be able to shut off this specific spyware, that specific spyware, but they won't be able to stop ads. Do you know what I mean? Like, they can't.
Yeah. It's kind of the perfect setup.
They can't check every ad going up, right? Like, in that sense, it's a very scary loophole.
Omer, since you broke this story yesterday, has there been any talk among policymakers about what's going on?
This, for a lot of people in the digital rights space, was actually just kind of like a big sigh of relief, where they're like, we've been warning that this could happen, and now finally someone's proven that it's happening. People think that it's too complex to understand, and I'm really kind of against that. I think nothing is too complex for anyone to understand. I think everyone should have an opinion about digital arms, the same way I have an opinion about nuclear bombs, though I don't know how nuclear bombs work. Like, I could never build one, right? But I still have an opinion about it, and I want the general public to have an opinion about digital arms in the same way.
Omer Ben-Jacob is a reporter for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Omer, nice digging. Thank you for sharing.
A pleasure. Have a great day.
The Royal Ballet School is Britain's most celebrated dance academy. It's produced some of the UK's most famous ballet dancers. But earlier this week, the institution faced public allegations of bullying and body shaming coming from dozens of former students. Other ballet schools in Britain are now facing similar accusations. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has our story. And a quick note, some parts of this report may be upsetting.
Winning a place at the Royal Ballet School in London is pretty much the dream of any young dancer in Britain.
It really was that, like, Billy Elliot moment where you get the letter and I ran up to my room. I was just like, wow, this is it now, like, this is my life.
India Thompson from Yorkshire in England was just 11 years old when she got that letter, and she told the BBC this week she couldn't wait to start at the prestigious school. But a little over a year later, Thompson says she hit puberty.
I, you know, started to get like boobs and a bum and things like that. So then it all starts with all the "you need to lengthen out" comments, which doesn't mean anything to anybody really, unless you know what it means, which means you need to lose weight.
Thompson says one teacher told her to stop eating carbs. Some nights she says she would wrap her legs in plastic wrap, hoping she could sweat the weight off that way. And when she did lose a few pounds, she says she was praised. 2 weeks after dancer Ellen Elphick joined the Royal Ballet School, a teacher made a comment she would never forget.
She got me side on the bar and just basically said to me, if I had a knife, this is what I would cut off. And she literally cut my entire bum off, kind of all of half my thigh, basically, and then a third of my calf. I was just filled with hate for my body because that's my muscle. I can't get rid of my muscle.
Elphick developed an eating disorder that lasted more than 15 years. She's now suing the Royal Ballet School. Her lawyer, Dino Nocivelli, tells me he represents several survivors of child abuse in Britain.
I've got lots of experience of abuse in sport and school settings and religions and elsewhere, but not ballet. And the first thing which came to me was, how has this been able to go under the radar?
And Nocivelli says the problem isn't just with the Royal Ballet. It's several ballet schools across England. Nocivelli says he's talked with young women who were hospitalised with eating disorders, but when they returned to the ballet schools, the body shaming continued. A number of dancers even took their own lives, he says. The demand to be thin is nothing new in the ballet world. George Balanchine, founding choreographer with the New York City Ballet, famously said in the 1970s that he wanted to see the dancers' bones. But lawyer Dino Nocivelli says that was more than 50 years ago.
The question I have is, how come everyone else can move forward? And it's, you know, 2023 now, but yet ballet is still in the 1980s, 1960s. And this comment about perhaps I just wanted to be thin and athletic. You cannot be expected to perform to the highest standards, the highest jumps, the fastest spins, if you're operating on a couple of hundreds calorie per day.
Nocivelli says British ballet schools still deny there's a problem. Trauma psychologist Gail Sturrock has counselled hundreds of dancers in England. She says there are many excellent ballet companies in the UK, but she says she's also heard countless stories of abuse at some schools that's been going on for years.
We've got so many children and young people and people who've left dance training many years ago telling us exactly the same story. The same things have been said again and again about the same people, and the stories are all lining up.
Many of the most prestigious ballet academies are boarding schools, and the classes are behind closed doors. Sturrock says there are no other witnesses to the abuse, and the young dancers are reluctant to speak out.
The child can't say, even anonymously, this teacher is bullying me, and this is how I feel, because no one's listening. It's like, you know, this is an elite school, you're an elite athlete, you're being treated like an adult rather than a child. And if you can't do it, you'll be out. That's how it works.
Gail Sturrock did try to raise concerns about one particular ballet school in England a number of years ago. But she says she got nowhere.
They tried to silence me. The local authorities have not been interested, and they just said it wasn't bad enough. I reported it to the police. I've gone to other authorities as well, because that's my duty of care as a practitioner. But kind of fell on deaf ears, really.
The police told her the young dancers themselves would have to come forward. But Sturrock says they were terrified to do so. I contacted the Royal Ballet School in London for their reaction to the allegations made by the BBC this week. they sent back a statement saying that the cases had either been investigated and resolved or did not align with the school's records. Lawyer Dino Nocevelli says more than 100 women have reached out to him in recent months. Many dancers just want an apology, he says, and an acknowledgement from the schools that the abuse happened. But the broader issue, Nocevelli says, is that the ballet industry in Britain is still unregulated.
Is anyone going to do anything about it? Because if this was abuse in football, the Football Association would investigate. With ballet, who is going to say anything?
The government needs to step in and investigate all of this, Nocevelli says, because the stories we've heard this week, they might just be the tip of the iceberg. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Social media produces some pretty unexpected trends. Here's a new one on TikTok.
Babe?
Yeah?
How often do you think about the Roman Empire?
3 times a day.
Elaborate?
Yes, men thinking about ancient Rome a lot. To figure out what's going on here, we're joined by Hannah Cornwell. She's an associate professor in ancient history at the University of Birmingham in the UK. Hannah, can you explain this trend?
It's quite fascinating, isn't it? What is interesting, at least from a popular understanding, is the apparent disparity between the genders and their interest in this. The whole trend started last year with a Swedish influencer who jokingly asked her male friends what they were thinking about. And it turned out that apparently they were thinking about the Roman Empire quite a lot. That was a common answer. And then her followers started to ask the same question to their male friends and relatives. And so it appears to be something that both in Europe, at least starting with Swedish influencer, but a lot of the TikToks or Instagrams I've seen have seemed to be coming from North America as well.
What do you think? I mean, what might it tell us that modern men are thinking about men and maybe women also 2,000 years ago?
The Roman Empire and the Roman state before it was an empire was something that was constantly changing and evolving, as any power or society does change and evolve. And so we've got to be careful that we're not thinking about a sort of singular static narrative of what Rome was. But it has certainly been used and continues to be used to perpetuate certain types of narratives. Rome is, and we can't escape the fact that it is or indeed was, a patriarchal society. And so people have studied recently about popularity or the interest in perpetuating certain ideas of masculinity and ideas about the West and Western civilization in digital communities online by men, and particularly the alt-right, because it allows perpetuating a certain type of idea and ideal. And certainly you can find those narratives if you look at the evidence for Rome, but that's also missing out on the great range of diversity that you can find if you study the Roman Empire.
In the TikTok videos, are the men specific about what images or ideas from the Roman era that they're thinking about?
Occasionally, if they're prompted to explain why they're thinking about it or what they're thinking about. I did earlier today try and send a group message to people in my sports club, both men and women, asking if they think about the Roman Empire, and if so, what do they think about? I've only got one response so far, and the response was from a man, which was frequently and shield walls. So thank you, Matt, for that. It's very imprecise data, so you don't want to be making assumptions based on sort of bits here and there. But evidently, there is something of interest in the Roman Empire, whether it is the longevity of the Roman Empire, whether it is in the success of the Roman Empire over a period of time to sustain itself.
Hannah, you get paid to think about ancient Rome for a living. I mean, how does it feel to know that some men are thinking about it in their spare time?
It's nice to see people sort of thinking about Rome, and hopefully it'll prompt people to think not just about perhaps a conventional popular culture image of Rome, but if we're starting to question why are people thinking about Rome and why are men thinking about Rome, maybe we might question the use of the past and how we use it in the present, politically or otherwise, whether it's just broadening interest in the past and in the diversity that we can find in studying the past.
Hannah Cornwell is an associate professor in ancient history at the University of Birmingham in the UK. Hannah, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
11 days. That's how long American researcher Mark Dickey was stuck in a cave more than 3,000 feet underground. He got sick earlier this month while mapping out a cave in southern Turkey and was saved by an international rescue effort and brought to the surface on Tuesday. Dickey spoke with the world's Dury Buscarin this morning from the hospital where he's been recovering. Dury, how did you connect with Mark Dickey?
So when the news first broke that Dickey was having a medical emergency underground, I reached out to all of these caving organizations that he's affiliated with. And today I got a Facebook message from one of those organizations, and turns out he's the one who monitors their messages most of the time. And it reads, "Sorry, I am Mark Dickey. I'm the only one monitoring this chat, and I was slightly unavailable."
Yeah, I guess so. That's amazing.
Yeah, he's very sweet and open about the whole thing. So I called him up.
Hi, this is Mark.
I caught him just as he was packing his things in his hospital room in the Turkish city of Mersin, just after being discharged. He had been admitted after experiencing internal bleeding.
I'm getting better every single day.
I'm really glad to hear that. Can you tell me about this cave, the Morja Cave? I mean, it's in the Taurus Mountains, one of the deepest in the world, and you were mapping it.
You're inside the cave, you're 1,000 meters down, and then there's vertical sheer rock going up. And so I go down there with all of the equipment necessary to physically take a drill and bolt my way up that rock face until I can hopefully get into new passage that leads to new sections of the cave. It is roughly 4 degrees centigrade, plus the humidity in most of the cave runs about 100%. You're pushing the edges of exploration.
So when you were down there, when did you know things were going really badly?
Oh, I was 80 meters in the air on the rope.
Oh, geez.
I had a really rapid and sudden onset of all sorts of negative symptoms. Felt my consciousness fading a little bit, dizziness. I'm again in really bad shape.
So Mark, at that time when he got sick, was with his fiancée, Jessica Van Ord. She's also a caver. And the base camp was a distance away, but close enough for him to get there with some assistance from her. And then Jessica made an emergency ascent back to the surface to get actual medical supplies and fluids to stabilize him. It took several hours for her to get up there, and he says that waiting for her to come back was the hardest part.
As time passed, waiting for Jessica to come back with the necessary medical supplies, and my condition started to deteriorate, I was holding on to consciousness with willpower. And that was the moment that I might live. That would be great if I live. But you know what? I just might die.
When she came down, he could only hear her voice, but he knew it was going to be okay.
I can just imagine. And then how did he actually get out of the cave after he was stabilized?
So cave rescue teams on the surface installed a system to carry Dickey out on a stretcher. He told me he was really comfortable on the rigging.
I had total faith in everyone. This is family. It was zero question that I was going to get to the surface.
And you said you plan to keep caving?
Oh, of course. Why would you stop? You don't run away when something goes wrong. You dig deeper and you keep going. This was a medical problem. If the medical problem is resolved and I have no outstanding pre-existing conditions, nothing has changed.
Wow. That's kind of surprising. I mean, Dury, you spoke with Mark when he was being discharged from the hospital. Where is he headed next?
So he said he'll spend a couple weeks traveling in Turkey, Hungary, and Portugal, partly to thank the teams who saved his life. And then finally, he'll get a chance to return home to New York. He said he's not 100%, but he's definitely on the mend.
The World's Dury Buscarin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Have a great weekend.